What's today? Tuesday morning. Welcome, everybody. So we're doing our review class. We're going to do a little differently this morning. So Miffy's going to take us through a visualization whereby we purify our motivation, and Nixie's going to take us through the some of the prayers in Tibetan. So first of all, make yourselves comfortable in your seat. Basically, this means just allowing your back to be nice and straight and your shoulders relaxed. Tuck your chin in ever so slightly. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, try to feel the movement of the inhaled and exhaled breath. Try to feel that movement at the level of your belly. And then imagine the lineage of the spiritual mentors, all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the 10 directions, are in the space in front of you. And you are sitting surrounded by the great crowd of every sentient being. And you remember that everyone equally wishes to avoid suffering, equally wishes to have happiness, and equally lack genuine happiness. Furthermore, we're all equal in that the causes of suffering can be eliminated, and the potential for a complete and a genuine happiness abides within us. So now, Miffy, would you like to do the next bit, please?
Yep, can you get the screen share up?
Sure.
Okay. So this image, it's a little bit like looking in a mirror when we're going to, as a memory prompt, to be able to visualize or imagine or even just feel the inner psychic channels that we have. So if you get stuck, then you can just glance at the image. But first try and feel those psychic channels as they actually exist within your body. There are three of them. They're like very soft and luminous light tubes in which all the energies move around your body. So the central one is blue. It goes from four finger widths below the navel up just in front of your spine within your body, made of light, and it curves around your skull a little bit like the shape of an umbrella handle, and comes kind of to rest in between your eyebrows. And then the two side channels are parallel to that, also curving around the inside of your skull. The left one white, the right red. And they meet and join the central one, four finger widths below the navel. So they're hollow, they're like a light straw, about the width of your little finger, very luminous. So try and feel them there within your body. And for the breathing meditation, just like Eddie described, all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas there in the space in front of you, feel that they are radiating incredible loving kindness and compassion and wisdom, so that all of the space around you becomes glowing with light. And the essence of this light is the, you know, the bliss of complete wisdom, compassion, abilities. It's like enlightenment, the glowing light of enlightenment. So we start by breathing in all of this blissful light through your left nostril. And the light flows through that left channel, curving up around your skull. And then as you breathe out through the right channel, and it pushes out all of your negative energy. And imagine the negative energy as black smoke, or like cigarette smoke, really disgusting, that's clogging all of those inner channels. So as you breathe out, the luminous, blissful light pushes out all of that smoke through the right channel. So do three long, leisurely breaths, in through the left and out through the right. And then swap the nostrils over, this time breathing in through the right nostril. So inhaling all of that blissful love and wisdom of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And this incredible radiance, light energy flows in through the right-hand channel as you breathe it in. And as it reaches down below the navel, and swaps over to the left-hand channel, and it pushes out all of the darkness of your negative energy in the form of smoke. Feel that the smoke is quite forcefully expelled. You might even feel that those channels, the left-hand channel, may be quite clogged up with negative energy and smoke. So as you do this next three rounds, really feel how that negative energy has nowhere to go but to be pushed outwards as it flows up that left-hand channel, curves around the skull and out the left nostril. So three times with those, with the nostrils swapped over like that. And so now that both of the side channels are cleared, then breathing in the light through both nostrils and feel that the light energy flows through those two side channels. You breathe it in fully into your body. It flows down those side channels all the way to just below the navel, and then breathe out through the central channel. And it clears the central channel of all the darkness of your negative energy, all the doubts and worries and anxieties and confusions in the form of smoke that is pushed upwards and outwards through that central channel, curving up around the inside of your skull and exits just between the eyebrows. As the smoke exits your body, it just disappears into space, into emptiness. So again, three long leisurely breaths in through both nostrils and out through the central channel. And feel the great relief of having expelled all of that negativity. Feel how your channels are clear and radiant. How your body and mind have been purified. And then we can recite the refuge prayers. So if you know them by memory, that's great. If you have the gold prayer book, they're there on page 34. So thinking that we go for refuge to all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, to the Dharma, the medicine, the Supreme Assembly, and that by our Bodhisattva practice, devoting our life with this attitude of universal responsibility, may we quickly become a Buddha for the sake of all. O Sangye Chedam Sokye Chonam La Chanchu Padu Dani Kyapsu Chi Dagi Jinso Kyupe Sonam Gi Trola Panje Sangye Tropa Sho Sangye Chedam Sogye chanam la chanchu padu dani kyapsui chi tagi jinsoi kyepe sonam gi trola penche sangye tropa sho. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And the seven limb prayer. Gosom gope gone chatsalo no sham yitro chatri malupo. Dormen esai dirton time shesha Kirpai kirwa nam la jayiram Kowa maton padu lejone Trolai cheki Kolo. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merits of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So, Eddie, we can put the spotlight back to you.
Okay. So we're staying here on the slides now and we'll begin the class. So this is in brief, this is the material we've covered. We've looked at the purpose of meditation, what its function is, and the different sort of postures, and a particular posture of sitting in the posture of Varachana. We looked at different types of meditation. The major ones, of course, we focused on here were the analysis meditation and the meditations of just being of stabilizing. Look at the importance of motivation and dedication, different obstacles, which are mainly the obstacles of excitement and dullness, and the different antidotes to them, which are mainly mindfulness and introspection. And I'm not sure if we looked at impermanence, but we will do today. And I've relied upon these books here. Now, in terms of what I just said about impermanence, the two very best books for this are this book called Science and Philosophy in the Indian Buddhist Classics. That's up on the top there, around about the middle. And then down on the bottom, there's a book called The Foundation of Buddhist Practice by Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron. So those have got the best explanations I've come across for gross impermanence, and but more importantly, subtle impermanence. Walking Through Walls has got a fantastic section on the posture, the 9-round breathing meditation, and lots of questions and answers from students about different aspects of the meditation. The other books like Steps on the Path to Enlightenment, Path to Enlightenment, and Gradual Awakening are all commentaries on the Lama Tsongkhapa's Lam Rim. And there's a book up the top here called In Praise of Great Compassion. So this is the new book in this series that the Foundation of Buddhist Practice belongs to. And it's also fantastic in terms of explaining practices of great compassion and the preliminaries to it. Anyway, these are all books that I've used and quoted from in our presentation. So today we're just going to review the material very briefly. So there are 9 questions put forward in the suggested public exam. And basically I'm just going to answer them all, put them all in one place. That way if you choose to do the exam yourself and you're uncertain, you can find the answers here. So I think what I'll do is just briefly go through this just as a review type thing. And if you have questions about the material specifically, then bring them up as I go through, and I'll finish a little early, and then you can bring up questions that don't deal specifically with this, but stuff that you might like to know anyway. So let's begin by looking first of all at the purpose of meditation. So it's in brief this: just to become familiar with positive states of mind and to decrease negative states of mind. That's the purpose. So the process of it, of becoming familiar it's the process of becoming familiar with a virtuous object. That's the positive state of mind. And virtue is a phenomena or something that functions as a main cause of happiness. So to become familiar with positive states of mind and to decrease negative states of mind. And in brief, meditation is this process of becoming familiar with these positive states of mind or with virtuous states of mind. Now, as I said before, there's many different forms of meditation. There are two major ones, the stabilizing and the analytical forms of meditation. And in brief, to stabilize the mind in meditation is just to have the ability to remain fixed on a virtuous or neutral object for as long as we wish without distraction. Now you can see here is another object, more than two, called neutral object. Now the neutral objects here are mainly to do with the breath itself or the mind, just the mind without, just the bare nature of the mind. So these are neutral objects. And what's wonderful about doing that is that oftentimes when we find ourselves distracted or in a non-virtuous state of mind, perhaps being angry or depressed or something, you've actually got to sort of move from that state to a neutral state of mind and then cultivate the more positive state of mind. So other names for stabilizing meditation are placement and concentration. And the next two terms, karma abiding and shamatha, refer to the same type of meditation, which is a type of concentration meditation or a form of stabilizing meditation. So there are many stabilizing meditations which are not karma abiding or shamatha. With karma abiding or shamatha is one of the aspects or one of the types of meditation whereby you stabilize your mind. And the aim of stabilizing the mind is to strengthen the mind's ability to focus on a single object or topic, which in turn enables the mind to overcome the problem at its root. It also helps you to become more alert and sharper in daily life, gradually increasing your powers of memory and sort of sharpening the mind. In brief, analytical meditation is defined as a process of examining various points of view until you thoroughly establish the truth of the object or the view. Now the objects that we apply analytical meditation to are practically all the objects are in all the topics of the graduated stages of the path to enlightenment.
Eddie, so Anne, I think, has questions about analytical and placement meditation and a little bit about objective and subjective. So Anne, if you want to unmute yourself, you can, and ask your question.
You also have it written down, Miffy?
No, she just said she has a question about it. Okay. So,
where are we?
Yep, we can hear
okay. you. Okay, yes. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I was just busy writing and trying to work it out. It's just that I get confused between analytical placement, objective and subjective. If analytical is subjective and placement is objective, or if they've actually got nothing to do with each other, it's just a different way of looking at them.
No, they do have something to do with each other, and they are also sort of different ways of looking at them. So
they don't correlate, though, those two, like objective, subjective.
No, don't, because just analytical is just objective, and that's it. It's not a subjective thing. So
right.
That's not the case. And stabilizing is not, it's only either objective or, and it's not subjective. That's not the case either.
Okay.
And so, like for instance, if you're doing an objective meditation, so now we've got analysis and stabilizing right on one side. But now we know we've got those, we know what they are. Now we're going to look at objective and subjective meditations. So subjective meditation, when you do a subjective, it's actually your mind is being changed. The mind itself is being changed. And that can come about through the process of analysis. But to do analysis well, you've got to actually place the mind on its object. So there you have the stabilizing meditation.
Okay, I've got that now. Okay. Yep. Thank you.
That's one thing. In terms of objective, the object here may be impermanence, subtle impermanence, for instance, or say emptiness. That's this object. So then we have to place our mind on it. So there's the stabilizing meditation. And then we're going to ask ourselves these questions about this object. So we don't make our mind, the mind, which is the subject, we don't make it impermanent. It's already impermanent. But our object that we're focusing on is impermanence. And we're trying to learn as much as we can about it so that we stop grasping at things with the mind to be permanent.
Okay. That one's a little harder, but I've been able to see the difference. I think I was putting them all into a bowl, like mixing up a cake with the whole lot instead of looking at them all separately. And
So you could look at it. Yep. The idea of just they put them separately, but then you can sort of bring them together. And
yes, because they do all relate to each other. It's just it's almost like a process that they.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is. It's process and sort of there is relationship between all of them, but it's at the same time. It's like I said, when we talk about subjective and objective, the subjective aspect is really about the mind being familiarized with something and being changed.
Yeah.
But like with the objective one here, I mean, that does also come about too. So now we have the object, right? So we have, okay, so let's go, our object is to learn about sort of gross impermanence, for instance. So gross impermanence is death. So the mind doesn't die, right?
Yeah.
But we know a heck of a lot about the process of death. And to do that, we've actually got to sort of place our mind on that topic, and then we do the analysis. Like there isn't anybody who has been born and never died. We go through, is there anybody that is still alive? Been born? You go, no, that's true. Yep. So we take on that knowledge. And you might say the knowledge may sort of like changes the mind, but it doesn't become dead.
So Eddie, are you saying subjective meditation is where the mind becomes one with the object? And the objective one is when you're placing your mind upon it.
Well, yeah. So if we go for instance, if we want to, if our topic was the loving kindness, for instance, well, we're going to make our mind an entity of love. So it's actually got to place on the object, this object called loving kindness. We do the analysis, we do the meditations, and the subject aspect, the mind itself, changes into an entity of love.
Yep.
But if it was to be like I said, subtle impermanence, that's not what happens. The mind is already impermanent subtly by its nature.
Just to confuse things a bit more. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I get that. Yeah. Yep.
Eddie Sue has said subjective is how we attend to an object.
Yeah, you could say that.
Okay, well, let's go on a bit and I'll let you know the other questions when they come up with the next topics.
Yep. There's a finding psychoanalysis that sort of works by analysing the object again and again, examining it from many different angles until you understand it all in all its detail. So you have to sort of begin by producing a small understanding of the object through like listening and studying. Then you have to become accustomed by thinking about it in various different ways. So this is something that you'll find I hope you do this. It seems to me that there are a number of people who read it or listen to it, and then they ask questions about it, but it doesn't seem to make much difference to them. It's like they haven't sort of put it together. That they're understanding, it's like they say, yeah, I understand, I know that now, and that's where it stops. And the change doesn't actually take place. It's like they sort of haven't integrated the understanding that comes about through reflecting upon what you have heard or read. When those two things, sort of come together, when the wisdom has arisen through reflection, you meditate on that. You become really familiar with that. So this analytical process, this process of meditation that we call analysis, has got a number of stages in it. First, listening or reading, then really thinking about it. In the Tibetan tradition, they debate. But they argue, you have an argument with somebody basically about what you've understood. And the other person is trying to sort of throw you off your understanding and trying to mislead you. And what about this and what about that? But if you've analyzed well, if you've reflected well upon the topic, you won't be thrown. It's like, this is the truth. So then you establish that truth deeply through now what they call meditating on it. It just means you're becoming more and more familiar with this object until it becomes a part of your life, a way of living.
So Anne's saying it's about becoming, taking what we learn through analysis back into our actual practice, like of our...
That's right, into lived life. So for one of the things, for instance, if we have meditated, okay, so there's two meditations that the Buddha said are just, dynamite. The two big ones that really make the biggest difference in your life are impermanence and selflessness. They're the two biggies. So impermanence can lead you to selflessness. Now, you say, okay, so what's so great about, how would my behavior change if I thoroughly established the truth of subtle impermanence within my own being? What effect would that have on my behavior?
Well, I mean, just reflecting on this, the effect that COVID has had on everyone's behavior, which is not quite subtle impermanence, but, impermanence in your face upended everybody's life, and yet it's always been there, that kind of uncertainty.
Yeah, okay, so that's uncertainty.
Yeah, which is like change, impermanence.
This is slightly different. you could draw quite different deep understandings of something being uncertain and something being impermanent. So anybody, what do you think would naturally flow from a deep understanding of things being subtly impermanent? If you don't know, it's okay, because we'll cover it. It'll come up later on, but this is really to do with the topic of impermanence, which we haven't spoken enough of. So let's leave it there. You have a think of it. And when we come to the slide, I'll ask again, and maybe it'll, you know, the penny would have dropped.
There are a few answers already, though, hun, that not grasping at appearances because we know they'll change.
Yep.
Or not getting upset if things were broken or if problems, because we understand that they'll change.
Yep. Okay. So when we come to meditate, there are different postures we can use. This is the one that is, you know, the ideal posture. Probably none of us can do this. So sometimes it's said the 7-point Varachala posture, and other times it's called the 8. If it's called the 8, it's because they've bought in the idea of the breath. If it's 7, they've left the breath out. Nevertheless, the most important aspect of these 7 is the spine, of having the spine straight as possible, but sort of like natural. The reason for this is so that the winds or the energies that move through the body have this nice straight course to go up and down. But that's the major one. So I've noticed in myself, this came about just through listening to I was being led in a meditation by Alan Wallace, and he said this really simple thing, which was like, so when you're sitting there, think as if you are a guard, that you're guarding something. And when you do, lift your breastbone up slightly. And man, that made the biggest difference. It was like, we're sitting there and suddenly it's like, whoa. So you can find these, what is that funny? They're sort of unexpected things that happen once your body gets lined up well. So this is the spine is the most important. It's called this posture. There are many, benefits from doing it. And you can see here, I've written some of them down. You know, so having your legs and the hands is like a way of pacifying jealousy and hatred, so they don't suddenly arise up. The spine, of course, is the major thing, is to pacify confusion. Another word for confusion is ignorance. So when the energies don't flow smoothly up and down the spine, then other stuff will happen, like anger, hatred, all the negative stuff can come up just because the winds aren't free to move in the particular way. So by having the spine nice and straight, we can pacify confusion. Also, like here, when the shoulders are raised, it's like becoming more tight in the body. But really, you know, I mean, you can read more about this in the walking through walls, and also there's another book which is on the next slide if you want to know more about this. Like I said, for us at the moment, at least in terms of the examination, the most important aspect is the straight spine. And the purpose of having a straight spine is to sort of have some control over the winds in the body and to pacify confusion. Now here's the other book, The Study and Practice of Meditation by Leah Zala. And actually, a lot of the materials come about from her questioning the author, Geshe Lodro, who wrote Walking Through Walls. She was one of her students. And these are some of the benefits, once again, of the posture. So they don't ask you any questions about the benefits. They really just ask you about what's the most important feature of the posture.
So Eddie, just read those out for the...
Okay, so the benefits are to establish the predispositions for attaining the form, body of a Buddha. So this posture is called Virachana after the... And Virachana symbolizes the purified aggregate of form, of everything that's physical, but form in particular in relationship to the body. So this is what they're talking about, like the form body of the Buddha. So the form bodies of the Buddha, of course, are the bodies of the Nirmanakaya form and the Rupakaya form. Like I said, Virachana is the symbolizes the purified aspect of the aggregate of form. Secondly, to facilitate the generation of pliancy. So pliancy is this sort of where the it's got a number of meanings, but one of them is where the body has become very soft and pliable, which really helps with the mind then. The second is to facilitate progress. So in other words, it's saying like this posture is not easy to get yourself into, but once you are able to get into it, it makes progress in practice much easier. To make known the mode of behavior is the fourth. So this is sort of saying that this posture is different than postures for non-Buddhists. And this, which is on the other side, to accord with the posture recommended by the Buddhists, by the Buddha saying, well, this is the posture for Buddhists. And finally, it's to, like to say, to pacify or to purify the motivation. So, you know, when Miffy led you through that nine-round breathing meditation with the visualization, the point of doing that at the beginning of a session is to purify motivation. But it can also act as a preliminary or to what you call a predisposition or seed, a potential that's useful to be introduced to now for later if you get involved in tantric practice. So this does the same sort of thing. Actually, I remember reading in the Zen tradition, they say the whole thing is just the posture. That's it, you get that right, everything is simple from then on. So they spend a lot of time getting the posture right. And like I said, when I discovered, just thinking of myself being a guard and just lifting the breastbone up a little bit to be more alert, God, that made a big difference. So you can find differences can take place and be recognized by you just through slight changes in posture. I'm not even up, but even the eyes, of how the eyes can, where you place the eyes, that also makes a difference. So in the Lam Rim tradition, or the Galupa Lam Rim tradition, stages of the path, you know, the idea of the eyes is sort of like looking towards the tip of your nose, or without being sort of tightly focused, the eyes are just there, looking there. So a little bit of the nose should appear. Or else, looking about 3 or 4 feet in front of you at the ground. So the eyes are lowered. And you only have the hands in this posture of the in your lap with the thumbs touching and so forth. But like for me, I've got quite long arms, so I find that it really makes my sort of shoulders a little bit tight. I don't particularly like it. So then I find it much easier to place my hands actually just straight down onto the floor so my shoulders are completely relaxed, or I place them on my thighs. So, you know, for where we are as lay people, and some of us are getting a bit older like myself, then it hurts to try and get into these postures. So that doesn't help. The thing is to be relaxed in your posture, at ease, but with the mind alert. So this is the most important thing, is to make sure that you have your back straight, your shoulder, your spine straight, sorry. If the body is not relaxed and the spine straight, then problems arise. And problems that usually arise, simply put, are either pain, you start to hurt, or, and that's in terms of the body, but in terms of the mind, well, either you become really dull, or you become, the mind becomes quite excited and restless. So these are sort of the obstacles to our meditation that are arising, independent upon the posture of the body. So we're going to move on now to some of the problems that you could come up against. But does anybody have any questions about this little section, just on the posture?
Nothing on that.
Okay. Yeah. So then, so when we, you know, we've sat down and now we're
sorry.
Jeanette, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm sorry to butt in. I just wanted to ask about keeping your eyes open when you meditate, because I did Glenn's class last night, and it's the very first time that I've actually kept my eyes open all through the meditation.
Yeah.
But my eyes are really strained and sore after it. And I was sort of sitting looking in front of me at a cupboard, and the cupboard kept changing into different shapes. And I just thought, my eyes are getting so strained, I can't do this.
So I guess what you're doing is, when you're doing it, you're looking at the cupboard.
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is to have a soft gaze. So the cupboard is there, but you're not actually focused on it.
Yeah, I tried that. It's hard.
Yeah, especially when you, the natural thing to do is to look at things, eh?
Mm-hmm.
With the eyes, you know? And actually, when I went and did Glenn's course last year and the year before, one of the other students I was up there with was Phil, and he said he couldn't meditate with his eyes open. And so if you've been doing it with your eyes closed for some time, it does make it difficult to change that.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it can be done. So the thing is to have, I guess, in terms of what's appearing in front of you, make it as bland as possible so that you're not really interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And to try and, it should be appearing in front of you, but you're not actually looking at it or paying a great deal of attention to it. The real attention you're paying to is like the mind.
Yeah.
But but in the beginning, especially as we get a bit older, if we're more inclined to be inside, then when we first go outside, we actually pay a little bit too much attention. It's just one of the things we do. But it can change, you know. It's just like you're saying, noticing what's happening, talk about it like this, and then sort of try and adjust it a little.
Mm-hmm. Eddie, I think the key that Glenn said about this was to soften your gaze, and it's almost like turn your gaze inwards, and just like when we're daydreaming. So our eyes never get tired when we're daydreaming, because where the eyes are just resting on an object outside of us, but our gaze is inwards, so we're not straining and looking at something.
Yep.
Also, Alison's asked, do you mean that we have our eyes open wide or partially lowered? And I think...
In the Lam Rim tradition, so when you're meditating on the stages of the path, a lot of analysis, a lot of placing your mind on it, then the eyes are sort of looking downwards. In other meditations, they have to look straight ahead and be wide open. In another type of meditation, the eyes are gazing upwards. So it really depends. So don't use those elements like wide eyes wide open, because you're not doing the meditation that accords with that type of gaze. If you're doing Lam Rim, which is mainly what the Galupa is all about, our tradition, it's a soft gaze downward. So like if you're saying, it's like you're, it's like how your eyes go in your daydream, or you're thinking about something, but your eyes are open. But you're not really looking at anything or looking anywhere. It's really mental stuff that's going on. So his holiness is, so they often see in the text, they'll say, have the gaze down towards the tip of the nose with eyes slightly open. So a little bit, there's some light coming in, and you are reflecting upon the topics. His holiness is a little bit more looser. He says, gaze 4 or 5 feet in front of you, or three to five feet in front of you. Just look at the carpet. Have your eyes, softly focused on the carpet. And then you just think, you're not really looking at the carpet, but there's some light coming in, but your gaze is a little bit further, uplifted from your nose. Is that useful?
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to look at some of the different objects we can use to focus on. So in Glenn's course of the Mahamudra Dzogchen, the object is the mind. Lama Tsongkhapa said for the tradition that became to be called the Galupa, the object of mental focus will be a Buddha figure. So just as Glenn said, this is difficult, mostly difficult for people like us. Right? So yeah, they often said they just focus on the breath, the neutral object, or you could spend it on the feelings and so forth. Here it's the Buddha. So the question is like, why? Why does he ask us to focus on the Buddha?
So yeah, Alison had a question about this, Alison Lulam, with the placement meditation. Why is the Buddha image recommended?
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, it serves as an object of devotion. When you try to accumulate or accrue spiritual power through doing prostrations, offerings, prayers, and so on. So, you know, sometimes the lamas make these jokes to us about doing prostrations. So if you're doing a prostration, you could ask, is that a spiritual practice or a physical practice for the body? So the answer, of course, it depends. If you're trying to make yourself stronger by doing prostrations, well, you become stronger. It's got nothing to do with any spiritual path at all. But if you bring up an image of your mind, into your mind of a Buddha, and then start doing prostrations, that's very different. Right? So one of the things you might ask, well, what makes it different? Well, you say, well, having a strong body will be a byproduct of doing this prostration, no doubt about it. But actually doing the prostration is for me to develop humility, to lessen my arrogance. And that is coming about because I'm imagining in front of me a being of great power who can help me do that. So this is one of the reasons why you put up a figure of a Buddha. And you can see here it's related to what they call the seven limb practice. Reverently, I prostrate my body, speech and mind. I make offerings. So we see a Buddha and we think, okay, now I can make offerings. So we develop generosity and we decrease our stinginess. So this is spiritual power. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time. So this leads us to the second reason for having the Buddha being an object of mental focus, as a means for us to purify our broken vows, our broken pledges, the obstructions that we will, that we meet in practice. So, you know, we confess in the Christian tradition, you go along and you confess to the priest. If you're a lay person and you're not have anything to do with religion, you might confess to the person that you've harmed, or you tell somebody else what you've done, right, as a means of letting go of some of the weight of the negativity. In the Buddhist tradition, once again, you place the Buddha up in front of you and you confess in his presence and make a pledge to restraint from the behavior again. So this is the second reason for putting up, having the Buddha as the object of mental focus. At death, it's very, very powerful to be able to recollect the Buddha. Because what it's saying is that you have faith in the Buddha, so you die with the mind of faith.
So, Eddie, with this one, it's like, you know, what comes up when we're at death is everything that we're the most familiar with. So I suppose if we've just been familiarizing ourselves with a blank object like a wardrobe door or a candle or you know, a view, it's not as beneficial to us as, say, then just automatically being able to see the Buddha.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, for most people who die, their major concerns are with their families. And there's a lot of attachment towards family. But you can't have attachment towards the Buddha. There's no way you can overestimate the power, the compassion, and the wisdom of the Buddha. But we can certainly overestimate the qualities of our families. Right? So this is this wonderful, and no attachment here. Lastly, it really helps us to engage later on in deity yoga, in the ability to visualize a deity and then self-generate as one.
So Pauline's asking, is this like taking the Buddha as a refuge at death time, for example?
Yep, that's right. Yep.
I was also thinking, Eddie, when my mother Inta was dying and we watched the little Buddha several times, and so, you know, the story of the Buddha's life. Yep. And so watching it how many times, but just becoming really familiar with it, I actually started dreaming about the Buddha. So it really went in just those few times of having a video. So I'd really like something like that to go in deeply, you know, because our visual sense is so powerful.
Yeah.
To have an object that, you know, is so incredibly useful when you're, you know, delirious or dying or sleeping.
Yep, that's right. Does anybody else like to offer anything? Any questions or insights?
Alison had just said before about she left a clothes peg on the floor to gaze or focus at. You know, because a very simple object.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I've just been finding that I've had a few stressful moments in the last couple of years, and I always bring up His Holiness Dalai Lama, yeah, as if he's standing there watching me and what's happening, and that gives me great comfort.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, so when we visualize the Buddha, one of the things we should be trying to do, yeah, I mean, there's many different, reflections or things that we can think about when we imagine a Buddha in front of us. One of them that they say we should be doing, because so each time we engage in these types of recollections, the benefit is greater or lesser depending upon what you're doing. So if you can see that your own, for instance, is holiness, right? So when you imagine them, you'll see, it's holiness. But if you could also think to yourself, this is the Buddha of compassion, then it's much more powerful. It's the same sort of thing if you just see a Buddha figure in a garden and see, there's a statue of the Buddha. That's one thing. But if you see it as being like the, you see it, but you immediately think of the historical Buddha. That's another thing. But if you could also think, wow, the Buddha was this person who existed in, through the history. But what he did was he pointed out the nature or the possibility to become just like him. And I have that nature within me. So then it becomes a little different. And if you also think, and my teacher has, in fact, every human being has the nature within them, and my teacher has actually cultivated it and is a Buddha, then it's even more powerful. So often what they'll say as you go through this path in terms of these visualizations, they say to you, they remind you that if you're doing a deity meditation, that deity is the Buddha and is your teacher and is your own nature. So it becomes more and more powerful, this, what the changes, the differences it can make to you. And so this is why Lama Tsongkhapa is suggesting the Buddha figure to be the object of mental focus for those in the Gelupa tradition. Of course, this object will change later on. It's like, if you suddenly move towards the mind, well then, the mind becomes the object. But like Lama Tsongkhapa suggested, the Buddha, and these are some of the reasons for doing that. Now, when we meditate on an object of mental focus, many, many times it's not as clear as what you actually see with your eyes. And that is fine, because we're actually generating mental images, not things we see with our eyes. So in the beginning, the object will be quite vague, but as you become more and more familiar with it, it will become quite vivid. And one of the things that you might find is like, sometimes when you have a dream and a Buddha or somebody appears in it, it's very vivid. But if you just think about them, it's not so clear. It's not so vivid. Now what prevents the vividness is something called dullness. And what prevents you even thinking of them all together is just excitement or restlessness. So we'll look at those now. So there are different things we can do when we find ourselves being very restless, the mind being very restless, or in other words, being distracted through excitement. The most simplest thing you can do is to exercise. The benefits are immense. And the other thing, of course, is to actually be relaxed. So those are the really positive things you can do. Other things you could do is try and, discern the characteristics of restlessness. What does that feel like? What's it feel like in the body? What's the mind doing? Well, distraction is quite simple. It just moves straight off the object. It's not interested in the object. You often find yourself thinking about the future or the past. And it's always associated with what they call attachment. So to prevent it, you have to sort of know what these things are, distraction, excitement, these terms, restlessness, and remember it and be vigilant so that when it comes up, you know what to do. And one of the simplest things you can do is come back to the breath. Come back, just ground yourself in the body, slow down, and then start again. Other things you can do is like meditate on, in other words, meditate, remind yourself of how all these things you're interested in, they won't matter a jot when you're dead. And thinking about them now is just sort of like wasting your life. So you try and, depress the mind a little, become more grounded, and then come back to your breath, and then away you go on your object again. Anybody like to ask anything about this?
There's nothing at the moment, but I'm just wondering when I can put in Sue's question.
Well, we've got a bit of time still. So opposing sleepiness, the simplest answer is get enough sleep. Once again, another powerful antidote to sleepiness is exercise. Adjusting your posture, like I said, just that lifting of the breastbone. All these things sort of fade, then visualize a sphere of light and bring the sphere of light up and sort of push it out through the crown of your head. Raise your eyes. So this is something else that when you find yourself opposing dullness or becoming opposing sleepiness or becoming dull, when your eyes are going down, raise them. If you're really excited, lower them. You'll find a lot of times, like when you're thinking, your eyes go up. So, and then you think of all sorts of things. Well, if you notice that you're not focused on the object and your eyes are up, like bring them down. That makes a big difference too. Another thing is that we often think that we should be doing much better than what we actually are. Very simple things. Just accept where you are, relax a bit more, be kind to yourself. Another thing too with expectations, many of the, you know, if this is one of your problems, just look back over your life and ask yourself, well, when did I start to meditate? How much time do I actually spend? What's my mental capacity like when I'm actually doing it? If you do an analysis like that, you'll find that actually you haven't done all that much meditation. And the meditation you have done isn't all that good. So, of course, I'm not meeting my expectations. So drop the expectations. Another thing that we have is regret. So this is when you say things like, you know, I just can't meditate. It just doesn't work for me. I can't do it. All these sort of things. Once again, we're probably expecting too much too quickly. And as all of you will know, it's not easy to meditate. We've never really tried to, you know, we've looked outside ourselves all the time. Our focus is outer directed. And that's the way we've been. Now we've brought it inwards, and we just find it's a crazy mess in there. So we have to be realistic about working with the mind and gentle. So even just trying to meditate, that's a victory for you. Even just making the effort, you know, I'm really going against the grain here. And so whatever I'll do, I'll be satisfied with that, and I'll just go again tomorrow or tonight. So here we come to this topic of impermanence, and this might shed some light on some of the questions that you have. So it's defined as that which is momentary. And momentariness refers to not enduring for a second moment beyond the time of its occurrence. So this tells us that from the very moment of anything arising, it's in the nature of dissolution. So they don't even abide in the same in the second moment. So now I come back to that first question I asked you about, like if you could become, like if we're meditating on impermanence, and becoming really familiar with its meaning. Well, not just its meaning, but familiar with it, the way it occurs, and then to draw from that what that means for you. One of the things that really you will know that you're getting your head around this when your attachment diminishes markedly. But that's the major thing that an understanding of impermanence does. It just attachment towards objects, you know. Not only that, but the understanding, of course, that you're going to be separated from everything that you hold dear, you will be separated from. And actually, this process of separation is going on, like right now. And if you really get your head around it, you will not be subject to anxiety, which would otherwise arise in the face of parting with people that you love, the objects that you hold dear to you.
At first glance, that seems quite counterintuitive, doesn't it? That by meditating on impermanence, we're actually released from anxiety.
Yeah. Anxiety has anxiety is not in sync with the way things are. It wants things to be different. But this tells you whatever's produced through causes and conditions is changing within the moment. Even the moment itself is not stable. So it doesn't go like one moment, then second, this one moment, and then like second moment, as we normally think of it, 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. I mean, that's change. It's like saying that 1 second itself is changing. It doesn't go from one to two, being separate moments. So everything is in a constant state of change and flux. So if you look at that and think, well, that means me, then that means the other. And we have no power over that. That's just the way it is. So it's like this acceptance of impermanence gets rid of the anxiety. And the attachment. The attachment is overestimating phenomena to be not impermanent, but actually changing in some other way, or just being stable. And the other thing about, so then we come to subtle impermanence, right? So impermanence in terms of momentariness, which is what we said on the last slide, is called subtle impermanence. So gross impermanence just really means death. It's really talking about death. Gross changes about death. Before this phenomenon called death takes place, where the consciousness leaves the body. The body no longer has the power to hold consciousness within it. So in terms of our anxiety, anxiety not remaining from the time the very first moment to the second moment is even subtler. And anxiety disintegrating, even at the time of the first moment, is even more subtle. So this refers not to just anxiety, but to anger, to lust, to greed, to all the negative ones and all the positive ones.
So Eddie, with this one, might be time for Sue's question.
Yes, it is. Now's the time for Sue's question.
So she said, even when, quoting from B. Alan Wallace, The Attention Revolution, and he said, even when your attention is settled in the present, you may still grasp onto the appearances of the mind. Whenever you prefer one mental object over another, whenever you try to control the contents of your mind, and whenever you identify with anything at all, grasping has set in.
Yep,
so right. Sue's question is, what's meant by whenever you identify with anything at all? Is this what we sometimes call fusing? Fusing the imputation occurring due to a strong familiarity of I, me, mine.
Okay, let's just put aside that last little bit about the fusing stuff first and go back
to whenever you identify with anything at all, grasping.
Yep, that's right, there's a grasping going on, yep. Next bit.
So is that what is grasping to do with fusing?
Yeah, grasping plays a role in fusing, yeah. So one is, so let's imagine being in the state that Alan Wallace has put ourselves in, right? So we're looking, so appearances are arising. The mind is throwing up its appearance. So the grasp can take place of two objects here. One is the appearances, one is the subject, the person engaged with those experiences. So suppose you have an appearance arises that you find very disturbing. The grasp will take, you grasp at the appearance to be real and true. That's one. You grasp at yourself as being real and true. That's the other.
And experientially, when we grasp at ourselves as being real and true, like, is that when we're just going, no, I don't want this?
When we look at how the self actually exists, it exists in mere name. That's how we actually are. But what happens, so the grasping will take place at the aggregates as being me. Now, then we're going to go, oh no. Then the rest follows. We have aversion towards appearing in front of us. So now what we can do is fuse the subject and the object, and in this case, a disturbing appearance. So, you know, when we say those things, when that fusion takes place, we're saying, so we have an object, a fearful appearance, and the grasping of the I and the appearance, so fusing, I'm scared. Because if we say things like, you know, like I was scared, there's an I now that is quite independent of this fear, right? Talking about it as a fear was something different from it.
But also, Eddie, you can be so scared that there isn't the thought, I'm scared. You're just
fearful.
Yeah.
But that's the saying. After that experience, when you talk about it, you can go, I was scared. But when we talk about I'm scared, there's still a sort of a objective thing about it, isn't there?
Yeah.
But there can be, like I said, even beyond that, it's like, you know, the experience of it is the fusion of the subject and object, person and what's being experienced. Now, then what was the next thing about the fusion business?
So,
the imputation. So,
is fusing the imputation occurring due to a strong familiarity of I, me, mine when the mind contacts a certain appearance?
Say it again. A fusing taking.
Is fusing the imputation.
Oh, is this the question? Is fusing the imputation
occurring due to a strong familiarity of I and me and mine when the mind contacts a certain appearance?
I'm not clear what's being asked here.
So does the fusing happen because we have such a strong familiarity with grasping at an I, but it kind of, the the actual process comes into play when the mind contacts an appearance, say a fearful appearance.
So let's go back to think about imputation first. Because there's something about imputation there, wasn't there?
Yes, is fusing the imputation occurring due to a familiarity with
it's I. Fusing the imputation occurring.
Yep.
So the question is fusing the imputation occurring. Next bit.
Due to a strong familiarity or grasping at I.
Imputation occurring. So we've got a number of ways of imputation, Sue. So the most common one is where we use language. Right? So I love, there's a great analogy for this, is that we have a long, sharp stick. So what do we call that? Long, sharp stick, isn't it? So we're calling that. So we're imputing the name long, sharp stick to this object. Then if you get some feathers and you put it on the into the stick, at the, one of the ends, the blunt end, it's called arrow. So imputation is that bit of adding something. What we add to things are names. So that's like, you know, then we come back to the person. What's the person? Well, we've added to the aggregates of the mind, mental aggregate and the form aggregate, we've added to it a feather called person or I. That's the most common way of imputing. But there's another whereby what we call imputing is like the mental images that are arising in the mind. Because if you look at what the mind's actual nature is, it's just clarity and knowing. Right? And you know, these meditations that Glenn is leading us through is to, you know, just get to that. The images that are arising are imputed. They've been overlain, they're extras.
And Edie, is the strength of that due to the self-grasping, then contacting an appearance that makes that happen really strong? You know, because everything, it's kind of like it's at a low level. We're not even aware of the imputation happening until an appearance arises. And then due to our strong familiarity of self-grasping.
Yep, then we grasp at the images that have been imputed, or we grasp at the mere self to be inherently existent. So that the appearances appear to be true. You know, so we grasp at truth, true grasping. We can also grasp at the self, the viewer, engage with those images. So have a grasp of being independent of them. Other times it's grasping at them being one and the same thing. So when it's like one and the same thing, it's like grasping at inherent existence. When they're sort of separate, you're grasping at them as being like autonomous, independent of one another.
Edie, just also, Anne had a question about these words imputed and aggregates.
Yeah.
Trying to kind of put it into her own words. So would an equivalent word for imputed be projected?
Yep, that's right.
And would an equivalent word for aggregates be parts?
Yep, That's right.
They both work.
Yep, they both work.
Fairly well. Yep.
Yep. So, you know, like we have a body, and it's, you know, it's made up of parts. They call that the aggregate of form. So when I say that it's called the aggregate of form, what's being projected to all those parts is the name form. Does that make sense, Anne?
Yep.
Okay. Or, you know, projected to all those parts can also be body or form. Form, when we talk about the aggregate, but ordinary people, we project body to it. Or, you know, projects with language.
And so then, getting back to Sue's question, I'm thinking it's kind of like almost, you know, like in the 12 links, kind of showing a very subtle process, kind of moment by moment, of how the whole thing eventuates. And we may call it fusing in a Western term, but there's a whole lot that's going on underneath all of that with identifying with things. And when we identify with an event or an event happening to me, that process is grasping, isn't it?
Yep, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we call that, yeah, just like sort of like fusing the event with I, with me. I was thinking another one too, if you know, like when people have qualities, they fuse the qualities with themselves.
Yeah, well, people fuse their status, their wealth.
Right. That's right.
And don't even know that they're fusing that until you lose your job, and then suddenly you lose your self-confidence as well.
Yeah. You lose your whole sense of self, don't you? Your sense of self is threatened by a new occurrence of impermanence and change, yeah.
And so then what is the driver of that process, the main driver?
I'd say, you know, we call it... in Buddhism, it's called in the Pali tradition, they call it craving or thirst, the thirst to become. Right? The thirst to be. So you'd see this in that book that you have, Sue, right? This new book on Buddhist psychology. You know, within the Abhidhamma. That material's in there.
So this, the thirst, though, it's also just the grasping at appearances, sorting them out, isn't it? Nice, not nice, like, don't like, or want, don't want.
That's an aspect of it, a later aspect of it.
So is there a way of experiencing the appearances of the mind without grasping?
That's what Glenn's material is going through. This whole Dzogchen thing is what it's leading you to have the appearance. But see, if you know that appearances are just appearances, you don't have to grasp them as being true.
But if we instinctively grasp at them, then we've kind of got to unravel the grasping, isn't it?
That's right. This grasp is like, you know, that's right. So you look at the grasping as, that's right, that's the problem. It's not the problem is not that the appearances appear to be true. The problem is grasping at them to be true.
And because we actually fuse with all of this psychologically, it's so difficult to extricate ourselves from that.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is why it's very important. You know, we often start off with looking at the grasper, the person, the I who is doing the grasping. And then when you find there's no such thing as that, no person exists like that. So there, straight away, a sense of release. But then, like I said, then what happens is the appearances are still arising, and then people can grasp at them. So Alan said in the first, you know, the first bit of the quote that Sue mentioned, the appearances appear to be true. So now we have to turn the mind, our understanding of selflessness, to the mind itself, to the appearance. What is this? What are these appearances?
So, for instance, in terms of the appearance of being miserable, you can do a whole analysis of the I, but you could still feel miserable.
Well, there's no I for me feeling to feel miserable. You find that I just exists in mere name. The problem that the grasping is going on is grasping it at the two things, misery and I. But you remove one of them, then what's who's going to be miserable?
So we're grasping at two things, the misery and the I. Okie doke. Right.
Yeah. See, so, you know, when they talk about, I think you said it the other day, if you but so we look at phenomena. Yeah, it's the examination of phenomena. Well, persons are part of the category called phenomena. They're just artificially separated. You know, there we go. Okay, so then we could look at the person being lacking true existence or inherent existence, then we could move it across and having a look at the phenomena. But actually, persons are phenomena. But like you say, you know, this is what one of the great things that they said in the text was, if you remove the idea of a self being, the person being self-autonomous and, what's it called, autonomous and, there's another term. You can do that, but it doesn't stop the appearances appearing to be true.
Self-powered.
Yeah, self-powered. Like, you know, I guess Oprah was saying on Sunday. So it's not enough. It's not enough just to think that you're, to understand that you're not independent of it. You know, this idea of being autonomous or self-sufficient. Self-sufficient and autonomous. That's fine, but every appearance still appears to be true. And then the grasping will take place again. So the really deep object to be negated here is the self being inherently existent. Meaning, you know, being the things that you're engaged with. So in terms of the mind stuff, it's like you are that. The sense of the Sue asked about fusion. That takes place.
Okie dokie.
Okay, we're just about over, so let's look at the importance of dedication. Last bit, what's dedicated? Our virtues. Why? So they won't be lost. We're aiming for them for supreme enlightenment. For whose sake? Everyone. How to dedicate them? By uniting method with wisdom. So we already have the method, which is the what we've done, what we've dedicated. That's the done thing now. When we bring wisdom to it, we've got to remember that the merit, it doesn't truly exist. It doesn't exist as it appears. It exists in mere name. But that's enough to bring about a mere result. The nature and merit never be lost. It will be a complete cause for enlightenment. And doing it ensures that the merit is not lost and continues to increase and expand. And you'll know that there's, you know, when we dedicate merit, there's a couple of verses, which are these two stanzas, are actually called the King of Dedications. And it goes, just as heroic Manjushri knew how, just as Samantabhadra also knew, I dedicate all this virtue so that I may learn to follow all their ways. I dedicate all my root virtues in whatever way all Tathagatas and all three times praised as best. I dedicate them toward these noble deeds. So it's interesting hearing Manjushri and Samantabhadra singled out. is about, you know, the bodhisattva. So the reason for that is because Manjushri symbolizes the wisdom, and Samantabhadra symbolizes the method. So you bring these two together again. So in brief, we've answered all the public exam questions. There were 9 of them. And in the future, have a look online. As it says here at the LTC website, resources tab, YouTube channel. Have a look at this How to Meditate stuff there.
Oh, sorry, Eddie, I'll jump in here. Yeah. Alison went online to try and find all the Discovering Buddhism DVDs on YouTube, and it can be quite confusing. So I've just made a new page on our website in the Watch and Listen section. There's a tab there now called Discovering Buddhism Videos, and they're all there on our website. So you don't even need to be logged in. They're just easy to find. I found all the units of all the Discovering Buddhism. And they're also on our YouTube channel as a full playlist. So there's a couple of places you can find it. And thank you, Alison, for the brilliant idea.
Thank you, everyone. We've come to the end of our class. We're just a couple of minutes over. So I'd really like to dedicate now.
Alison's saying, thanks, Miffy and Eddie. Can't wait for the next course. So there's some rejoicing right there. Double your merit now, Alison.
So I'm going to dedicate all the merits that don't truly exist but do exist in their name to us, who also exist in their name, becoming fully enlightened, which has no intrinsic existence whatsoever and exists in their name, for the benefit of every living being who cannot be found from the side of their body and mind. Instead, they exist in their name also. So may our enlightenment come about as quickly as possible. And until then, may we be good people and be generous and kind to everyone we meet. Okay, everyone. Thank you very much. Put your cameras on. I'll go, woohoo, and see you later.
Cameras on, everyone. Hello.
Hello, everyone. Hey, Anthea. How are you? Nicola, Pauline, Sue. Nice to see you all.
Thank so you gave us a run for our money today.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Excellent.
And Jeanette, you're using Zoom like a pro now.
Alison, Deborah.
Oh, I know, I'm getting better.
Hey, June. Oh, it's great with this thing I can see you all up on the screen at once. It's fantastic. Okay. Bless you all. Keep trying. See you later.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.